Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, April 29th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that webpage and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We help people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, you can call us live at 563-999-3581 and press 1 on your phone. Or you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. Or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get a comment or a question from you in that format, we will address it on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. And we're greatly appreciative whenever anybody does that, whether they call live or they send us an email, because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be a service. And if you can let us know how these things are landing for you, it's far easier for us to accomplish that. We have support groups that are available absolutely free on Tuesday and Thursday nights from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. We have the website that Michael and Jeannie maintain at whyagain.org. We have the website that's basically a companion for that. That's mindshiftersacademy.org. And we are hopeful that all of these resources are making it easier for you and people like you to learn about these tools and then build expertise, build competence in applying them, actively applying them in your life. On Friday, we were just talking about an overview of the work and for the most of the show, and highlighting the idea of ways to use these reality management worksheets and the general process of recognizing that I'll never be upset unless I'm holding a goal for something to be different than it is, and that goal is not getting met. And if I can tap into that, just that direct observation, you know what? If I'm sitting here in my life and every single goal I have for everyone or everything in my life is getting met, it's just not possible for me to be upset. So, by extension, the observation is there that if I'm upset, that means I'm holding some kind of a goal for myself or somebody else that isn't getting met. And most likely in that moment, I don't have the authority, the ability, the immediate, you might call it power, to make it be what I want it to be. And what we've observed in this work is that when that's happening and I keep focusing on the goal, all I'm doing is distracting myself from the actual process that's creating my upset. And that actual process is always an inside job. And so since our goal is to help people live healthier, more productive lives, and the only way to do that is to be able to interrupt a pattern that I'm actually engaged in, even if it's unconscious, that is producing discomfort in me or the negative emotions that I don't want, the only way around that is to wake up to how I'm doing it, turn the focus to the inside of myself where that actual dynamic is happening, and for the most part, step out of the conscious logical realm, because none of us would consciously, logically create a negative emotional state unless it was helping us reach some kind of an other goal or dynamic and avoid something even worse. It's one of the fundamental observations I make in my work with people that now after 50 years of doing therapy with people, I've never met the person who actively wanted to make their life miserable. And so whatever I'm doing, whatever anybody else is doing, they've got really good reasons for doing it, even if they're not consciously aware of that set of dynamics or reasons. And that's why we keep turning to tools like the reality management worksheet and the targeted journaling that Michael calls the mind shifter tool, and to books, studying books like The Way of Mastery that ask us to just engage in this fundamental level of observation soon and often. Over and over again, just observe, what's the truth? What can I see? What can I experience? Not what do I fear, not what do I blame on someone else, but what can I, if I test it, and this is one of the things that Guy Finley was talking about the last time we played a vintage Guy Finley discussion. And he says, you know, the way the world works, the way life, the way truth works is that you can't act on what you think is the truth without life or the truth actively showing you whether or not you're on target. And so you keep learning. Even when you think of what you're doing as having failed, there's a lesson there. And as he talks about, you know, the life lessons we need right into our lives on the back of events we don't want. So the more we can stay in that mode of observing, the more we can catch ourselves getting tight and resisting something and learning that life is just going to keep flowing and if we want to make the best of our lives, we need to keep in direct awareness, living from observation, staying connected to the truth of what is in the moment. And that's the only reasonable way to keep improving our lives. Everything else, all of this idea about living from belief and living from dogma and living our lives the way other people tell us we should, or wanting what other people tell us we should want, rather than staying connected to the flow of life in the moment, and as the way of mastery would call it, the energy of desire, which is always present, which, you know, might be phrased as the energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through me in each new present moment. If I stay connected to that and I observe the ways in which I can act from that energy in alignment with my values and priorities and in accord with the needs of others in that moment, I can make my life better and better and better. And when I start to ignore that energy and when I start to try and live because somebody else tells me I should live this way or that way, I create more and more conflict, more and more stress, more and more struggle in my life. And as the way of mastery is pointed out in one of our lessons that we've read already, the way is easy and without effort. And it keeps talking about how we need do nothing. We have choice. And everything we're doing at one level or another, we're choosing to do. And when we wake up to that, then we experience it as a choice. And instantly, even if it's not something we would prefer, if we're choosing it because we're working to avoid other heavier costs or avoid breaking with our values and our loving nature, then it isn't as difficult because we aren't creating this false sense of being forced or pressured. And we're realizing we're choosing this. We choose what we do. And as we awaken to that actuality of choice, we can choose in each new present moment to do things like choose for gratitude, choose for allowance and surrender. We can choose, as Lesson 18 was calling us to do, we can choose to bless all of creation in this moment. We can choose to make that our purpose. We can choose to make that our one true function. And that was in the way of mastery where I was reading, as I left off the last time, was the section titled, Your One Function is to Bless Creation. And I'm going to back up just a little bit and read from the beginning of that section. The function of the Holy Child of God remains eternally one function. The Holy Child of God has one function, and that is to bless creation and thereby restore it to the perfect reflection of creation's presence. And creation is but love. Love embraces all things and trusts all things. Love is the nature of your being. When you finally choose to awaken completely by welcoming capital L love back into your mind, and by becoming committed to resting only in loving thoughts, you will discover that illusions are just that. They contain no solid existence. You have been resting in the holy mind of creation eternally. So creation then waits on your welcome. Creation waits for you to embrace it. Creation waits on you, the anointed child of the Creator, as that one who is the Savior of all things. You are then the Messiah. You are then Christ incarnate, to the degree that you become crazy enough in the eyes of your world to simply assume the truth, capital T truth, and you become completely committed to listening to no other voice than the voice for love. Or, as they talked about in Lesson 4 of this book, the energy of desire, which is the energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in this moment. So the text goes on here and says, "For there is given unto you one teacher that I have called the Comforter." I've called this teacher the Holy Spirit, the voice for creation, placed within your mind in the very moment that you dared to dream the thought of separation, the thought of guilt. And guilt is the mother of fear. Beloved friends, take a moment. And just for the fun of it, practice making a simple decision. This takes no effort since you do it all the time. All day, every day anyway. You already are a master at this. In this simple decision, just observe the place that you are right now. If you're alone or you seem to be alone through the physical eyes, look at the so-called objects around you. Feel the temperature of the air. Hear the sounds that come in through the ears. If you're with others, include them, their brothers and sisters, in this observation. Decide to look upon these things with perfect innocence. And then say within your mind, which is to just use the power of the mind to literally create perception. And simply say, as you look at each object and person, quote, "I do not know what this is for. I do not know what my brother or sister needs," close quotes. Breathe and soften and realize that it is not necessary to know. It is not necessary to analyze and interpret. Your function is to bless creation with the reality of the love of Christ. Yet that blessing will hold no power until you return to the beginning. The beginning is just the state of unknowing, not knowing, and realizing your complete ignorance. For this Christ mind, this anointed mind space, the Christ mind does not store perceptions and knowledge. Christ eternally in this energy of love and creation, with all that creation is, Christ merely opens and receives and gives, knowing that that which is given comes not of him or herself, but rather through him or herself, and comes from the infinite mystery of creation itself, what I have called Abba or Father. When you decide to fully accept the one purpose given to you in reality, there will be nothing that will block your way. Every step you take will literally take you through obstacles that dissolve as you approach them. For because you abide in the mind of the creation itself, you know no limitation. The realm of illusion, what appears to be solid matter of people with different opinions, this realm holds no power to prevent you from bringing forth the blessing that heals all illusion. Creation, then, waits on your welcome. That requires that you choose to look upon all things in the world and of the world and dismantle all of your judgments and perceptions about them. Or the phrase they use in this text is to forgive it, which means to dismantle your judgments and your perceptions. Why is that the case? Because until forgiveness is genuine, until the dismantling of judgments and perceptions is complete, embracing the thing as it truly is not possible. Because your images about something, your judgments about it, which come from the past, are not the same as the energy of creation expressing in the moment. It's not the same as the truth of life in that moment. So the attempt to embrace creation while judgment is still held in the mind merely brings a great frustration. It's like reaching out for the carrot at the end of the stick and never being able to reach it. That is why we've spoken so much about the importance of the process of forgiveness, meaning the importance of the process of dismantling judgments and perceptions. This dissolves the barrier of fear between you and what you've come to perceive as something other than or outside of yourself. And what this teaching tells us is nothing is other than or outside of you. Forgiveness, as this dismantling of judgment and perception, is the bridge that brings creation to you and you to it. And when you have joined with it through forgiveness, through this process of dismantling judgments and perceptions, now the embrace is easy. For that creation rests in the palm of your hand. Creation waits upon you because it is powerless. Creation, being the extension or the reflection of thought, means you are the literal creator of the world. The world exists nowhere save within your mind, the world you experience, your perceptions. When you're angry, your anger only exists inside you. When you're fearful, your fear only exists inside you. When you create a judgment or interpretation of someone or something, that exists only inside your mind at that moment. The text goes on and says, therefore, what world must you embrace? Must you travel to some ancient monastery 50,000 miles around the planet somewhere, two or three times, in order to find the creation that awaits on your welcome? The answer is no. Must you go anywhere to discover the ability to bless and to heal? The answer is no. The world that awaits on your welcome is quite literally the thoughts and perceptions that you discover streaming through the field of your unique awareness, and that is all. Beloved friends, there is nothing outside of you. If you would know the Creator's will for you, merely look upon what is arising within your own mind as a perception and ask only this, quote, am I willing right now to use time constructively to embrace this creation that's passing through the field of my awareness and thereby bless it with the perfect love of Christ, close quotes? First, embrace it through forgiveness, which returns it to its neutrality, because you're going to dismantle every judgment you have against it, every tightness and tension, every resistance that arises in your mind about it, every perception of it. And when you do that, it returns it to its neutrality and powerlessness. And then through that embrace, you bless it. And thereby, you dissolve the illusory power that it seemed to hold. The next section is titled Cultivating the Practice of Blessing the World. As you choose to truly practice being the presence of Christ, as you cultivate the practice of blessing the world, you will discover a very interesting thing. You would swear that many of the thoughts or what seem to be experiences or emotions that are passing through your screen of awareness, many of them do not seem to have any causal link to anything you've experienced in your current lifetime. For those of you that have done the inner work necessary to create a transparency of the barrier between lifetimes, you'll not even necessarily be able to find a causal link between the world, the creation that is passing through the field of your awareness, and anything you've ever experienced as a unique ray of light through multiple lifetimes. Why is this important? Simply because the human mind tends to take the whole process of awakening far too personally. In reality, there is nothing that is personal. There is only Christ as the Creator's true and only creation. And the field of illusion that has been birthed through the freedom of that mind, that one mind, capital M mind, when it once thought, quote, I wonder if I can create something unlike the creation itself, unlike God, close quote. Those are the only two options, love or fear, reality or illusion. Therefore, all that you see is that is unlike love, these are just merely passing phenomena arising within the holy mind of the Christ as temporary attempts to do something different than what the Christ was created for. Therefore, when anything arises within the mind, it is truly not necessary to analyze it. Certainly, do not argue for it, but rather come back to the point of ignorance. Here's a suggested reference point for the point of ignorance. Quote, I do not know what this thought or this image or this emotion or this memory is for, but I do know one thing. I have made a commitment to awaken as Christ. Therefore, I will use this one moment, this one thought, this one passing phenomenon to practice what I was created for, to bless creation and thereby transform it into that which extends the good, the holy, and the beautiful. It extends that infinitely, eternally, with joy, with innocence, with graciousness, with peace, and with marvel at the great mystery that love is, that creation is. Close quotes. As you come to truly understand how simple your task is, your burden will become lighter, for you will discover that you cannot help but be in the right place at the right time. Those committed to awakening to the creation itself recognize the great gift of each moment. As in these statements, quote, here is my Father's will right before me. This is the moment that is crying for love, close quote. This is the moment that will be repeated ad nauseum until somebody, might as well be you, decides to bless it. Somebody has to bless creation. And if it isn't blessed, if it's resisted, if there are distortions and perceptions and judgments created about it that are rooted in fear and rooted in the dream of separation, it's going to keep repeating until someone blesses it. Might as well be you. Creation waits upon your welcome by merely holding the thought within your mind, quote, all right, it's okay, it's all arising within me anyway. I've tried in a million ways to avoid it and to get away from it, and yet it seems to follow me wherever I go. I might as well sit down on the park bench here, have a nice cold glass of water, listen to the birds sing, and simply bless creation. Close quotes. The text goes on and says, now, many of you are not yet to the point of truly transcending or creating the transparency of what you've identified as your, quote, personal stuff, close quotes. That stuff which comes up within the eye, within the phenomenal world. And that's fine. As you simply practice blessing the world as it arises in your awareness, that very sense of, quote, I, close quotes, becomes increasingly transparent until it simply dissolves away in light, capital L, light, as though it had never been. In the meantime, come back to what we shared earlier. Time is given to you that you might use it constructively. Therefore, do not seek to trample on what you call the ego or the sense of a personal self. It's simply there. It is also arising. Are you willing to bless it? Are you willing to just embrace it, trust it, allow it, surrender to it, see it, its true nature? So many of these teachings at different levels talk about destroying the ego or getting rid of the ego, and yet the fact of the matter is, it's a useful tool. It's a part of our lives. It's not going to go anywhere. We wouldn't survive very well if we tried to destroy the ego. So what's the point? The point of it is to just understand it. The point is to understand its relationship to our awakened heart, to our connection to insight and intuition. The point is not to attack the ego. The point is not to attack anything. The ego is a part of the creative process. We're using our mind energy to create our ego, our sense of thoughts about ourselves, our judgments. And as we bless them, as we allow them, as we see them for what they are, they lose their power over us. I just got a text that said there's a static on the line and it's distracting. So I wonder if anybody else is having that experience. If you have the experience, you press 1 on your phone, please, and let us know. Do I need to hang up and call back in to clear static, or is it a nice clear phone signal that we're putting out? I'm turning on the microphone for Susan Bingham. Susan, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Kim. Yeah, maybe it's just me. I have called back in, though, and it's still going.
Okay, well, for the sake of clarity, I will hang up and call back in and see if it clears up.
Okay.
All right, so we are trying again. And someone else said, yep, lots of static. Do you hear any difference, Susan Bingham?
You have to unmute me.
I have unmuted you. You are there.
Oh, okay. Okay. No static. Good job.
Okay.
That did it.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I was about to say that, you know, I've had a couple experiences. One of the ones that I was digging into is this Buddhist thing over the weekend, and depending upon which teaching you have, the Buddhist teaching, this one was by Pema Chodron, there's a deep realization that we aren't being invited to shred our ego. We're just being invited to understand it.
Mm.
And, you know, the more you go into those teachings where they understand, okay, this is a very useful tool as long as we're here in the physical realm. It isn't a bad thing. And yet it was never intended to be our primary user interface, so to speak, for life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if I just recognize what the Way of Mastery is calling us to, if I will engage in this process on a regular basis of questioning, do I really know what this is or what this is for? If I come at life with this childlike innocence and curiosity, and I question everything, especially when I have tightness or tension or any negative emotions, then I open myself to an entirely different possibility for engaging life and understanding it. So as I mentioned Pema Chodron, I just have to mention, years ago, somebody sent me some CDs from Pema Chodron, and I started listening, and my experience of those CDs was that Pema Chodron had a very heavy accent, so much so that it was difficult for me to get through them. I didn't listen to all the CDs. I barely got into one, 5, 10, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I tried several times. The accent was so heavy. Are you familiar with Pema Chodron, Sue?
I am, and I've read. I love what she writes, but I don't think I've ever heard her speak. That's very interesting. I'm sure there are lots of videos of her or podcasts.
Well,
of her
here's the thing. Right now, I have this experience where somebody else said to me, Pema Chodron has this thing that's available on Sounds True.
Mm-hmm.
It's called The Noble Heart. So I got it and started listening to it. And it's got no accent.
Oh. Wow. Are you
Then I went to Facebook or to YouTube, and I loaded up some things with Pema Chodron, and who knows? Is it actually her voice I'm hearing? Everyone I listened to, there was no heavy accent.
Oh, weird.
So this is just an example of how we create these perceptions in our lives, and we live our lives by them, and they can be dramatically off the mark.
Hmm. Maybe so that static wasn't real either.
Pardon me?
Maybe that static wasn't real either.
Probably was.
Yeah.
It probably was. But here's the idea. Any teaching like this that asks us to question is really useful. Because especially when we're in tightness or tension, we're probably not perceiving the world completely and accurately.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I had somebody send me a link over the weekend about the horrible thing that all of these New Age teachings are doing, teaching us about the Christ mind. And when I listened to part of this YouTube video, it was all about people who are doing literal translations of the Bible. And they're warning that, you know, we are becoming the Antichrist if we're believing that, you know, things like the Way of Mastery and what these teachings are. So, I'm just encouraging people on a regular basis, just try this for yourself. Notice how your life quality exists, goes up or down, as you question everything you think you believe, especially if it comes from some kind of an ancient teaching. Question it. Try it out in your own life experience. And let your own life experience be your teacher.
I think that's a great idea. That's the only way to do it.
Well,
I wanted to ask you a question back a ways. You connected guilt and fear.
Yes, well, the
idea
is... Can
you say more about that?
Yeah, the idea is that in this kind of a teaching, it says that we decided to try and make an experience of life that's other than what the Creator created. We decided to see if we could be separate from our Creator. And that's the idea of guilt, right? That we're trying to... It's like the child rebelling against the parent. And then it goes horribly wrong. So in the moment when we try and dream this dream of separation, we're creating the guilt, creating the fear that we may not get it right, and the fear that we might be attacked by our source, our Creator, our, you know, the powers that be, and then the guilt of trying to be different than what we were created to be, the guilt of creating something less than love. So that's my understanding of that reference. And it's also saying that fear at every level was born in the moment that we decided to pretend we're separate, to dream the dream of separation, and then fear was born. Because prior to that dream of separation, there's no separation, there's only the one, there's not us and the one, and there's nothing to be afraid of. Because there is just this perfect safety, this bliss, this, you know, life experience.
Gosh, that, I've been working in parallel with Tim Bingham on this DNRS, these exercises. And one of the things you do after you do all these steps with matching motions that help you remember the steps and also re-establish healthy brain pathways, one of the things they have you do is go back to a memory. And most of us, I imagine, go back to a time before we became conscious in a secondary way. We were children having the experience of our lives, and if it was a good experience, most children, I assume, have had magical times when they were young, go back to that, and you're getting to the point where you haven't left the Garden of Eden. You haven't separated. And if you spend some time there, the idea is, and I've experienced this now every time I do it, experience that magic sweetness. It isn't a matter of being separate or not separate, but maybe it is. Just the complete acceptance of what is happening. The child just observes and takes part in, is part of a life, and somehow there's tremendous pleasure or joy in that. And it seems as if it wasn't that we were born with original sin, but somewhere in there we did it, and it was when we became conscious in a different way. The Garden of Eden is, of course, a myth that's trying to explain that. But we've all been in the garden before we ate the apple, I think. And
I think that's the truth of the teaching, yes.
Yeah. So when we become conscious, we become fearful and we feel guilty, all of that. And I ask, I'm exploring this partly because my son, in his incredible struggle right now, he talks about how he wakes up feeling incredibly guilty toward his partners in the hospital. He left without warning, without due process. He just left and left them having to fill in for him, take call for him, stay up nights. And he feels very, very guilty about that. That I would call a secondary guilt. But the reason I asked you about the connection of guilt and fear is I wish I could kind of translate it back so that he could feel the origin of the fear and the guilt, which he feels in such crippling amounts now that it takes him a while to get out of bed. Sometimes he doesn't. He just wants to hide from his whole life and wonders if he can live his life. So it's connected with depression and all kinds of other things. But I did tell him about the DNRS exercise, and he said, I can't remember a time in my childhood that was like that, which absolutely blows my mind because I remember that little guy running around and appearing to be having a wonderful time with friends, playing, you know, baseball and touch football and getting a group together in the schoolyards and spending afternoons doing what they did, running around playing street hockey. And I think, has all that been lost? Because of the
well, it's not lost. It's just that he can't access it right now because he's got a different mental process going.
Sure does.
But it doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean it never happened. Just like my memory that Pema Chodron had such a heavy accent that I couldn't listen to her doesn't mean she had a heavy accent.
That's the weirdest thing, though. I wonder who you
well,
were
I mean, but those kinds
to.
Of but those kinds of things happen all the time.
Yeah,
right.
But that's
a remarkable
example.
But they happen to us all the time. The point is, they're not. It's not so remarkable. It's just one that I've caught. Because I've got all the pieces falling together right now.
Mm.
Right? And so what happened? I don't know. But I need to know. I need to make sense of it. Okay, well, go ahead. Try and make sense of it. You can make sense of it dozens of different ways, but it doesn't matter. The point of the matter is, for this observation where we think we are so certain about what we're living and what we experience and how we're right and the other person's wrong, the point of it for this story is every time I'm in tightness or tension or upset of any kind, I'm probably in error.
Mm.
And the potential for me to improve the quality of my life goes up dramatically by leaps and bounds if I just acknowledge that and open to the possibilities. That, okay, as Guy Finley says, my anger doesn't prove I'm right. My anger only proves in this moment that I don't know what rightness is.
Mm. I still want to ask you, do you have the CDs? Can you go back and find them and listen?
No.
I know.
No, I don't still have them. But listen, so here's an idea.
Okay.
Here's an idea. Maybe it was Thich Nhat Hanh. And I know he had a very heavy accent, and I had difficulty listening to his audios, but I loved
now
reading
that
his
makes
books.
Sense.
Right? Maybe it was
that
him. And then I just transposed that name in my mind. And maybe it had nothing to do with that. Maybe it had to do with I just didn't like what she was saying, and I attributed it to an accent that was difficult. It doesn't matter, right? The point is, for our discussion, we all do this all the time. This is why the Way of Mastery has us working to eliminate judgment, every judgment at every level.
Fantastic.
Says, look, everything you judge is a distortion. And your mind is going to tell you you're right and the other person's wrong. But then you're going to be slumbering in your suffering. You're going to be suffering with your negative emotional state, your tightness and your tension, and you're going to be convincing yourself more and more deeply with each new passing cycle that you're right, and the world as it's unfolding is wrong.
Well, that would sure make life much more pleasant if we didn't react and judge things. That's for sure.
Well, and when we choose to engage a teaching like this, we can catch it and we can change it because as they keep telling us over and over again through this cycle, it's a choice. We are given the ability to choose. We're choosing the focus of our thoughts. We're choosing our perception. We're choosing to hold on to what we hold on to. We're choosing to value what we value. And that's why it's inviting us, as I backed up and read in Lesson 18, it invites us to choose to value only our loving thoughts and share only our loving thoughts. And since it's a choice, choose well.
Mm-hmm. Who is it that said, and it's probably true, that the mind tends toward the negative? Was it you who were talking about that the other day? Because we were hunters and gatherers and we...
There's this book that's called Buddha's Brain. Mm-hmm. And it talks about, you know, when this pattern of thoughts that we have in us now, this brain that's in the head, has been developing for millions of years. Mm-hmm. And when we lived out in the wild, and we had all of these various things that could be poisonous, and they could be, you know, we were not
predatory.
At the top of the food chain kind of thing and all that stuff.
Mm.
So we developed a pattern to over-predict for negativity.
Mm.
Why? Well, because those of us that were skittish and fearful, we would duck and hide from every little noise, whether it was a rabbit and some dry leaves, or it was a deer, or it was, you know, a bear.
Mm.
So those of us that were really highly skittish, we survived to pass our genetics along more than those of us who were really curious in the wild. Oh, there's a noise, I'll go explore it, and then I get eaten by a bear, right? Oh, there's a noise, I dive behind the bushes, and I cover up, and I freeze, and I survive. So that's a theory about how that particular pattern got so strengthened. If I get, you know, if I get bitten by a bug, and it swells up, and then I die, the people around me highlight, oh, what happened, and they notice, and now they're just paranoid about all bugs, any kind of bug, any color of bug, etc. Those people that stay away from bugs and find a way to cover themselves with mud so the bugs can't eat them, etc., bite them, they survive and they pass on. So it's that kind of theory. The other thing that they noticed is that we have a tendency to over-predict how much we're going to enjoy something once we get it.
Right.
And they say this is another thing that's evolutionary in its design, because we were foragers, and we would be traveling around, and we would stumble across a tree that has this really sweet fruit loaded with sugars, and when we would eat it, we would just gorge ourselves on this fruit. And then we'd have plenty of extra fat, and we'd be much more likely to survive the winter.
Mm.
And then, of course, we're foragers. We can't just camp out there by the tree. We got to find other stuff, because that fruiting of that season in that tree just lasts for a season. And the tree itself can't sustain us all year long. So we're moving around. But we have to remember, where was this tree? Right? And when is it going to bloom and bring those fruits to us, right? Well, so we, as we left the tree, gorged on the fruit, sick of the fruit, I never want to taste it again, right? A week or two later, we're thinking of the sweetness of the fruit.
Yeah.
And all year long, we're remembering how wonderful and sweet that fruit is, and we can't wait to get there again. And then sure enough, that motivates us to find that tree again, just as it's fruiting out in the season. And we start, the first few bites of that fruit is just heaven.
Mm.
And by about the 13th fruit that we're eating, we're sick of it again, right?
Yeah.
But we got to keep eating, because we got to pack on the pounds to make it through the winter. So the theory is, that dynamic in a variety of different situations accounted for us developing this habit of over-predicting the pleasure we're going to get when we acquire something we say we want. So, you know, there's an old adage that says, the pleasure that you're going to get from the new car that you've been saving up for, you experience most of it before you take possession of the car.
Right.
Because you're thinking about it, you're excited, and it's going to be great. And then you get it, and there's this phrase that, you know, the shine wears off the rose pretty quickly. And a week or two after you've got the new car, you're not as excited about getting in it. The first day you get the new car, it doesn't matter what's going on in your life. All of these other, it cost more than they said it would. Who cares? I got my car. I'm just happy as can be. 3 weeks later, I'm starting to regret. I've got buyer's remorse, et cetera. So there's that whole thing about the study of these patterns that have evolved in the brain, and they're trying to make sense of it based on an evolutionary model. And it holds together, makes some good sense. The truth of it, we don't know. You know, life itself is just going to have to unfold before we find out the truth of it. So you've taken us into our second hour. Thank you for that. I will mute you so you can listen to the second hour. Michael and Jeannie have become busied with other things, and so we're going to play the second part of the Beatitudes. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. This is your second hour.
Brahma. You know, it's exactly what we've been talking about with the Beatitudes, and that idea of the first law was to maintain this condition of mind. It had nothing to do with loving neighbor. It was to recognize and start to make a practice of maintaining this condition in your mind so that you stayed connected to the presence of love. And then to have the first beatitude we spoke about yesterday, the Greeks speak of, is blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And Aramaic says, the Creator implants in your mind neural structures which will guide you when they are active. If they are inactive, you who follow these instructions will come into conscious possession of and be able to use this latent guidance system designed to make available thoughts and actions that will increase your happiness and well-being. So the instruction set, the first one, which we covered yesterday with Mark, is you who have a home in the active forces from the Creator, yours is, and it was translated as a heavenly estate. The Greeks translated it the kingdom of heaven, but it really says yours is the community of love. And when we start looking at these Beatitudes, they're so profoundly powerful that, you know, oftentimes I've run into and heard, especially when we're working with children, people in the culture will say, well, you've got to let your children make their own decisions, their own choices, and, you know, you can't control. Well, you know, that's true, you can't control them, but you can help them to build brain cells and understand the principles by which their own body-mind units work. And when they do, they're going to be able to operate this body-mind unit as it was designed to be operated. And the people in the culture out there saying, oh, you've got to let them do their own thing, are there vying to control them and build into their minds what they want built into the kids' minds. So it's powerful to just know that there's a set of principles by which this mind operates well and always gives the most intelligent possible response when we keep moving, you know, and it's a process. You know, I think back in my life, and it's taken years to step one step at a time toward moving in this direction, and still slip sometimes. So I'm with you on that, young lady.
Yeah, and Mark is with her. Okay, go ahead. All right, because I want to yesterday, so I'd like to hear what's going on. Thank you. Blessings.
All right, young lady. Thank you. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you both and all?
We're rocking. How about you, sir?
I am as well. great to be back with you.
Oh, good. Yeah, glad to have you back. We just had a brief conversation about Rachma and maintaining that condition in mind, and so we were right in the middle of a conversation about your son yesterday when the show closed off, came to an end. So I just turn the floor over to you and see what else you have to share with what you went through. You know, you had been at the point where you'd said you were quizzing your son on whether or not he might be in error about his conclusion that life would be easier if he weren't here. How did that that complete with him, and how's he doing today?
So that conversation was, I mean, it was one of the real turning points, you know, for him, and I think just his recognition of what he wants, and just to refresh for anyone who wasn't here yesterday, my then, he was 11 or 12 year old son was talking about taking his own life, and so life brought it to my attention, and I sat down, I said, hey, what's your thought on this? And he reinforced it and said that he thought everything would be better. And when I dove deeper into it and said, well, what if you're wrong? You know, what if you have this opportunity to actually process through whatever's going on here and live fully here? And if you did, you know, go to wherever he thought he was going to go, that you'd have to the same work. And it just kind of, you know, had him pause for a moment to reflect that, wait, so it means I might have to do this anyway? Like, it may not go away? So he thought about it overnight, and I think it was the next day, it was Saturday, I believe, and he caught me coming around the corner. He's like, hey, Dad, can I talk to you? And I said, sure. And he said, I just wanted you to know I decided to stay. And at the time, though I don't have the emotion at this moment, at the time, there was so much emotion for me and this acknowledgement that we have our sovereign right to choose. And he didn't have to, right? And I know situations like that can turn a lot of different directions. You know, he could have, in another home, been brought to a doctor or, you know, diagnosed with something or, you know, all kinds of things, you know, put in a hospital. But in the matter of, you know, a few short hours, you know, with love present and the willingness to be in the conversation, which honestly, Dr. Tim had taught me, like, hey, if someone's talking about suicidal thoughts, like, talk to them about it. Don't be afraid of
right.
it.
Embrace
and,
it. Yep.
And he made that conclusion on his own, like, okay, I'll stay. I'm here. And he's doing very well. He's a teenager. He's 16 now, and he's about to get his driver's license and, you know, going through all the things teenage boys go through. He's such a loving human being, you know, a gentle soul. So it's really nice to see, you know, people make that choice. And I think that can be the case for a lot of people who are struggling just to have a conversation, to open up. Like, why? When I had suicidal thoughts, I was afraid I was going to hurt people. And I thought it would be better if I wasn't here. But it didn't mean that I shouldn't be here, right? And it certainly wasn't the case I didn't want to be here. And so there's a real opening, you know, that can be had, you know, when we can maintain our presence of love without drawing all kinds of conclusions and projecting, you know, into the future and doing the things that can amplify that energy. In this case, you know, and it's just one case, but in this case, it dismantled it very quickly.
Powerful. Powerful. What a gift. Yeah, you know, suicidal ideation, one of the things that they've shown in some research is that people who have a traumatic experience, and, you know, they label it PTSD. I don't think the D is really belongs in post-traumatic stress. I think it's just post-traumatic stress. It's the system's natural way of handling and trying to protect itself. But 10 times as many successful suicides come out of people who've had that post-traumatic stress type of syndrome. And, you know, that might be something to, you know, quiz him on. Was there something, you're aware of something that he went through that was traumatic? He saw something or what have you that maybe he still might need some support and processing. And, of course, you ask the same question of yourself, because that's oftentimes a major factor in the suicidal ideation.
I'll do that.
Yeah. Cool.
I certainly know that I have stress.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you tie it back to, and you know, words are such a key part of the whole process. If you look back at the power person dynamic from the codependence work, that oftentimes, you know, the way that regulatory speech works is we first hear speech, then we repeat the speech out loud, then we repeat the speech silently to ourselves, and if we repeat the speech silently to ourselves, we experience that the behaviors associated with that speech as reducing stress, then it goes into the regulatory speech system, which to a great degree determines behavior and, of course, language. And so oftentimes there's a power person dynamic involved, and the power person was somebody who had more power over your life than you did at some point. It's usually a child, though not necessarily. That person was not functioning as love. And when the object of that situation perceives the situation as survival, then it's like the gates are opened on their whole energy field, and literally like a sponge, they just suck in every energy from the environment. And if that's never opened and dealt with, and in the future, when stress is elevated to extreme levels, then that power person dynamic comes back into play, and there are really only three levels of behavior possible for an individual. And it doesn't matter whether it's 2 years later, 20 years later, or 80 years later. When there's no stress, the automatic decision system runs the game and we'll do whatever we did to get along with our power person. When stress starts to build, we'll do whatever we did to resist and survive with our power person. And when we become ultra-stressed, we'll do what our power person did to us that we hated the most. And so the child who hears certain speech and they're in that kind of stress situation, it can be a powerful governing force if it's never reckoned with, if it's never opened and forgiven.
That actually ties nicely also into the second beatitude.
Yes. Let's look at the second beatitude. So the first word of each of the beatitudes, tuve hun, and I'll repeat that, the Creator implants it in your mind neural structures which will guide you when they are active. If they are inactive, you who follow these instructions will come into conscious possession of and be able to use this latent guidance system designed to make available thoughts and actions that will increase your happiness and well-being. And it's you who, and I would, if I were translating it now, if we're doing that work, I would change the word love in this translation. So we've got you who love truth. We would change that now to honor truth, because our whole culture, you know, if you listen to Vladimir Lenin, he says, if you want to destroy a culture, just change the meaning of its words. And we've been given this definition of love that is a verb, something to do, rather than who and what we are. And if we're functioning out of that definition, you know, one of the first things that happens as young people come into the world, you know, if you hold a newborn child and you tap into the essence of that newborn, then that essence, if you, you know, we've asked thousands of people all over the globe, everybody's answer is always some variation on the theme of love. And then I ask people, well, now, is that newborn loving you, or is that newborn love? And everybody says, well, it's obvious, the newborn is love. So then when we use love as a verb, we set the mind on a pathway that towards something it can never achieve. It's going to be frustrated and blocked in that possibility when we realize who we are. So I would change that word now from who love truth, who honor truth, and profess your errors in the errors of your society, that we need to look into the thought structures that are based in hostility and fear. So this is the second step in making ready a mind to be available for the full and complete expression of the being that we are as love. And what this beatitude finishes with, you know, behind each day of beatitudes, there's a promise. The first one was, yours will be, you will live in the kingdom of, or the state of love. And the second one is, you'll be freed of mental stress. And, you know, the condition of the culture, by and large, is blockage of truth. And blockage of truth looks like this. I have a 9-bit mind. You know, perception goes into this 9-bit space. And my mind generates, especially if there's hostility and fear, a perceptual construct based in hostility or fear. And every perceptual construct based in hostility or fear is a lie. But if we call our lie the truth, we filled that 9-bit space of perception with a lie, called it truth. Now there's no room for truth to get in. So it's not until we honor truth that, I keep hearing a banging in the background, sweetie. Can you mute whatever that is that's doing that? So when we're in blockage of truth by calling our lies truth, then there's no room for truth to get into that little 9-bit space. So the willingness to honor truth always puts us into alignment with what's going on in the actuality. And when we're in alignment, my take is that when we're in alignment with truth, people oftentimes say, well, what is truth? My take is that truth is what is in the actuality. And if we don't have a different idea that blocks that out, it will come in and correct everything in us that's off base. So the result would be we'd be freed of mental stress, as Yeshua said 2,000 years ago in this beatitude. Your thoughts?
It's right on, and just for reference for people, you know, just to in case they don't have it on the top of their mind, the second beatitude in the English was, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. And you addressed the Aramaic extremely well. And one of the things that I mentioned yesterday is I've also gone back just to look to see, well, what did the Greeks say about it? And the Greeks use a word, I think it's pronounced pentheo, though I don't know Greek, so I may be mispronouncing it. And in looking at pentheo, it matches what you're saying. You know, pentheo, it talks of an outer expression of pain that can't be hidden. You know, so it's, you know, properly grieve over a death as an example. But one of my favorite parts of this is in researching it, someone said it's really about coming to divine closure. And in order for something to come to that divine closure, to have that, you know, really be fully healed, if you will, you know, there is this allowing that which was hidden, right? That which wasn't, you know, brought forth, as you mentioned, with the truth. When it is brought forth to the surface, then that pain has an opportunity, you know, to be expressed, and that a pain has an opportunity to truly heal and be resolved in the individual. And the powerful part of number two here is, just like one and two and three, you know, these are to be repeated, right? It comes in layers, as you've talked about before, that there's what's up is up, and allowing that to be there, allow what was hidden to be exposed and breathe into that, letting the hidden hurts and pains and the grief and the shame or whatever it is come forward in that space of love. And that promise of being comforted is so true. There's a peace that comes with this process consistently, every time.
There's an element missing from the Greek where they say, blessed are those mourning their wrongs. The element that's missing is that there's got to be the willingness to honor truth. We hear lots of people who mourn their wrongs so publicly on the news and in their speeches, and, you know, they're always whining about what's been done to them and how they're such victims and all of that. And the element that's missing from the Greek piece of the puzzle there is I totally missed this. The focus is, in Aramaic, is that, you know, the focus is on truth, the ability to honor truth, to be the space where truth is allowed to show up in the mind. And when people live in blockage of truth, what happens when truth shows up is their stress skyrockets. And that stress attaches to one of two things. It either attaches to getting rid of the source of the information that's delivering truth. You know, the classic example of that is John the Baptist. You know, he brought information to the king and queen that they were not interested in hearing. Their stress went up, and literally she had his head removed. And I always like to kind of tongue-in-cheek say, if you're going to play John the Baptist for somebody, if you're going to bring truth where people are in blockage of truth, there are two skills that John hadn't developed that you really want to make sure you got, and that is you got to know when to duck and when to hold the mirror up. So that people realize the stress they're experiencing is their own. And until one honors truth, they'll tend to attach their elevated stress to the outside world. The alternative to that is that we can, when we recognize truth is showing up, I've got a new level of stress coming up, I can attach that to self-correction rather than attack. I don't have to puke on somebody else. I don't have to criticize, condemn, blame somebody else. I can shift that into, here, my stress level's up. That's the truth. This is mine. I have work to do. And so I attach my stress to self-correction. And by honoring truth, when, you know, something painful or traumatic, something that appears to cause my pain or trauma shows up, then I can shift that out of cause and start to process my pain and trauma. You know, oftentimes people say, well, this event was so terrible, it caused me all this pain. And the truth is, nobody's ever been pained about anything that's ever happened in their lives, ever, ever, about anything. I mean, sure, shy of a punch in the nose, you know, okay, so there's some physiological pain. But otherwise, when people say, you hurt me, you upset me, you disturbed me, that's all a pure fantasy and a lie of the mind. If somebody's in pain, they're never in pain about something, they're in pain because there's pain in them. And if they live this beatitude, then because that event happened, they'll have the opportunity to heal that pain, and they'll stand as a connected space of love, maintaining rachma, and clean up the pain part, perhaps right down to including their genetics.
That's my lived experience with it, too. Yeah, it's... And it ties really nicely with just to share a lived experience for me as I was navigating the mind energy, if you will, the carbon-based mind of all these distortions. What would occur for me is I would consistently go to the breath. I mean, there was definitely a retraining that needed to happen for me to go to the breath and allow those active forces of God to really come into my life, right? That beatitude one. And then what my experience had been is if I had what I call a charge, where there's a charge of frequency that's from hostility and fear, et cetera, if there's a charge there, then that's contributing to blocking this truth. And so the willingness in that clear space that opens up from Beatitude 1, it's that willingness to say, okay, I'm okay allowing this to occur. I'm okay allowing. And I actually, not sure if I'm the only one who's done this. I doubt it. But I'm kidding because I know it's not true. But I had blocked certain emotions. I was under the misperception that certain emotions were not acceptable to feel. Anger was one, which is a big deal. You know, if I'm thinking that I can't feel, then what happens is that charge would build, and then kind of overflow when it got too much for me to carry, or it was just too much. So part of the healing process for me was to allow, to actually go through a feeling wheel, which you can get on Google, and look at each of the emotions, like, hey, what does this feel like? You know, what does surprise feel like? What is anger? What is fear? What do all these feelings feel like? And one of the things that I noticed as I first did that exercise is I couldn't distinguish certain feelings. Like, oh, I couldn't feel certain feelings.
Right.
So then I went through an exercise of saying, I allow myself to feel anger. And then the anger would come up, right? And I just gently start to see, okay, what is this? And I breathe through it. I'm like, okay, well, that's anger. Well, how is that different than fear then? Because I lumped some stuff together. And so just to reorient was a really critical part. Not that that's necessarily what Beatitude 2 is exactly saying, but in order to free ourselves of the lies and allow truth to really surface, this charge that's blocking the way needed to come up. So mine in this example was a hidden anger, you know, that I denied. And once I started to move into acceptance, it was probably a 6 to 8 month process because it kept evolving. You know, it's like it felt one way in the beginning, and then there would be moments where it started to, I would say, mature. And instead of feeling it at a really high level or too low of a level, it eventually got to a place where I recognized it when it was coming up, and I could acknowledge that, okay, this is anger. You know, what's happening? You know, is there an expectation that's being missed, or what is it? And allow that truth to come out by accepting that the emotion was okay.
Right. If you look at that beatitude, actually, you just described precisely what the beatitude says. Profess your errors and the errors of your society. What are the thought disorders? And oftentimes what I hear you saying is, you know, with the anger as an example, not allowed, that's oftentimes a power person message. And power person's allowed it, but you're not. And that's a really fertile ground for worksheets to clear that out of that power person, the false self that's based in the power person. You know, that when we talked yesterday about Yeshua saying, in order for you to live, you've got to die. The self that's got to die is the false image in the mind based in the power person dynamic. And it's the source of pained perception and stress that carries pain. And when we start to be willing to look at those errors, hold to honoring truth, hold the space for all of that to come up, that's when resolution occurs, and bingo, you're free to mental stress. It's just gone. It's like, here's how it works, folks. He wrote it down 2,000 years ago. Well, he didn't write it down, but you know, that's what he was giving us 2,000 years ago. The brilliance of the understanding is just...
And it opens the door to new perception. You know, I mean, it just opens the door to, it's like, oh, I 10 minutes ago might have thought one thing, but once this is cleared out, it's like, okay, now we move to Beatitude 3, where we let go of attachment to things being the way that we thought they should, or that, you know, whatever that piece is. But to let go and to say, okay, I'm allowing new information, and I'm going to allow this to be different than the way I perceived it. And it's been remarkable to see how quickly, and part of it's acceptance, because one of the things that I learned was there's a right answer, right? I was trained in school. I went to traditional private school and just, okay, get an A or a B or a C or whatever. So one of the things that I discovered in this, it's like, it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to not have the quote-unquote right answer. And the more I released what it is I thought I knew, the more I was open to seeing with new eyes and experiencing that particular moment. And then the next step was realizing that it's okay for that one to change. You know, 'cause there was there's a little time where I felt like, wait, well, now I have the new awareness, so now I'm right. It's like, no,
it
not necessarily, because there could be another wave, another layer.
Right?
It's fully recognizing just all we have is right now, you know, this moment. And so you mentioned the story yesterday about teaching for 27 hours without a thought. And that's it. It's like if you can stay in that present moment, then you're not trying to bring forward something from some past where you had kind of gotten it. You can allow for the fresh perspective, you know, that fresh insight
right.
to flow to whoever it is that you're speaking with in that moment for that group at that time.
And the answer might be different tomorrow. And what you just described, Mark, is exactly why in the worksheet, you know, the core of each worksheet is where you identify and cancel a goal. But then if you remember over on the right-hand side in the margin, I cancel my need to be right. I cancel my need to make up another reality based on this errored perception. And
right on.
Each worksheet that's like an integral part of it. And to me, that's part of allowing, is part of honoring truth and allowing literally the energy of the actuality to flood in and shift everything in me. You know, when we recognize that perception is nothing but a construct of the mind, and if something is in the mind and then turned into perception, obviously, whatever it is, it's from the past. And so when we live in what the world would call normal perception, we're literally engaging in the past again and again and again. You know, it's the essence of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And Yeshua said, of those who are doing that, you know, let the dead bury the dead, let the blind lead the blind. It's like, you know, you don't want to live there. And this part of honoring truth and then being able to look into our areas of thought, the areas of our society, clearing out these stressors that are held from the past is there's correction in carbon-based memory. And from that point forward, everything that comes forward from carbon-based memory to formulate our perception is at least accurate about the actuality, but it's still not the actuality. And the next level is where perception comes directly from being rather than from carbon-based memory. And all kinds of new information becomes available as we allow that to open, and it becomes enlightened perception coming from, you know, to give a mechanical metaphor, coming from above rather than below, rather from the past. It comes from the actual present, and it's, you know, beyond any kind of comprehension or explanation. It's just something you got to do for yourself and experience.
Yeah, it's and it's easy to experience by just doing the work.
What it
on
takes.
Whatever's in front of you.
Yep.
And I love the in the beginning when I remember first, you know, meeting you and in 2012 coming to the Why Again workshop, there was you may recall this, there was just this desire like what should go faster. You know, and over time, I've really matured into the appreciation of the particular insight and opportunity that's here. But in the beginning, I was chasing because I wanted so desperately to be healthy. And I would...
Everybody wants to storm the gates.
Yeah.
But you can't storm the gates.
You
just
got
to go through your process. Yeah.
Well,
I want this yesterday.
Right, and it's like you can't plant a seed in the ground and expect to pull the apple off the tree in a week. You know, it takes time. There's things that have to happen. And there's a process of transforming us, you know, through those active the active presence of God kind of transforming our nature into that nature. And that is going to take time. It's not like it suddenly got skewed overnight. We're talking about generations of
massiveness
that we have embodied through you know, the current generations, you know, and if the previous generations didn't clean it up, then we can either hide from it as long as we want to hide from it, or we can say, you know what, I'll do this. You know, I'll clean up, you know, what's going on in me and for my generations. And
right.
When someone makes that choice, it's a foregone conclusion because the willingness is there. So all the resources are going to show up. You know, they're going to show up in the form that's best for that person to receive these insights. And there's such a gift.
Right. As are all the things that they're going to have to face and deal with going to start showing up. That's the other
side.
Where a lot of people shy away. It's like, well, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this. I don't want to deal with this. But when you realize that the major attribute of this body-mind unit, the Adam, Adamos, the red clay, is this multi-generational database that is so huge. I mean, its major attribute is inertia. It's moving in a particular direction at a particular rate of speed, and it's going to take some pretty strong forces to change its direction, and that's the process of healing to literally, you know, when you look at that word repent, you know, the Greeks have abused that word so terribly, you know, repent, you sinner, as opposed to it simply means to turn your thinking, your mind in another direction. So rather than looking to this multi-generational database and its appearances, its perceptual constructs in the past, that we literally turn and embrace what comes from directly from the mind of love, directly from the mind of the Creator. And that's our birthright, to have our perceptions come from there. And, you know, again, each of these Beatitudes is the instruction set for how to clean up the multi-generational database. What's required? What are the principles behind it?
And it's so interesting, you know, to be having this conversation, because we're in a time when so much out in the world is being, you know, brought forward. You know, essentially the things that have been hidden, you know, are being exposed. And one of the opportunities that our society has is to accept and embrace, like, oh, this is great. Like, another hidden, like, crappy thing that got twisted gets to be exposed. Like, let's celebrate and let's do our work on it. And we can do it individually. We can do it, I think, as a group. What I've seen is it can be even more magnified, you know, when we're dealing with these, you know, larger outer things. But when I first began exploring kind of the inner journey, and I think this might be a common thing, my whole focus was, oh, we've got to fix it out there, right? We've got to fix this problem in the world. Over time, and this was prior to even my 2011 manic episode, but that helped me see, like, oh, wait, I can't do anything of value out there until I actually have what's going on in here cleared up. So
exactly.
It became obvious to me that, like, the only work to do is to be on in terms of our optimal state. And if we're not in our optimal state, we're off, then we have these tools to apply and get into that on state. And what happens later in the Beatitudes is we begin to be moved out into the world. You know, begin to overflow with that love, and we begin to be reframed in terms of where we place our attention, like what we do in the world. It becomes this, I would call it the divine plan, you know, and we start contributing in our way to what we're called to do there, but it's in a real pure space. And even then, there's no finish, you know, because even as we're inspired with our divine plan, yours being, you know, to bring this work to every heart, mind, and being on the planet, then you're going to have to face the things that might be in the way of that plan being fulfilled. So you're going to have to go through a process of really cleaning up every last vestige of fear. And then
absolutely.
Even if you do a great job at that, guess what? Not everyone's going to like what you're doing. And so they're going to come possibly and most likely, according to the Beatitudes, they're going to, you know, start to project upon a person who's carrying that out because it's conflicting with the way that they have wanted it. And that could be in a home, right, with a spouse when you're changing. It could
For
be
sure.
a family member. It could be out in the world with your company or your job. It could be on a massive scale, you know, with you know, large implications. So if we can do this work and support people finding this work, we have an opportunity to then have those people inspired in their line of work, and suddenly you have people all over the planet who are these beings of light, of love, in their jobs, in their roles, in their communiques, and there's an opportunity for massive transformation. But it doesn't happen by going out and saying, hey, let's massively, you know, change everything today. It's no, let's support people in doing the work as you've done over the last, you know, so many decades to have, you know, people like me and others who have said, hey, I'm willing to do this. You know, this is what it is, and people on this call as well, this is what it is that is the primary purpose of my life. And anything after that is going to come out of that. That
Definitely
shifts
key.
Careers. That shifts lives.
Everything, yep. For sure. Well, and this that takes us into the next beatitude where the promised result, in Aramaic the word is nartun, is gain the earth. This is where you bring it into manifestation in the world. So the next beatitude says, you who have humility. Now, of course, the Greeks mistranslate that word as with most of every other important word. And so humility has been used as, you know, groveling the earth like a worm. But in Aramaic, the definition of humility, and this is what this beatitude says, is to have that, is it's a mental quality of perceiving and cooperating with the good desires of others. And that when you do that, you shall gain the earth, the result. Now, the Greeks talk about it, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, like it's some sort of a passive, well, it's just going to come and fall on you, and you're going to inherit it. No, this is a very active, by taking it into your work and your world, there's something that you earn. They will literally earn this reward, gain the earth.
Yeah, and I love, in addition, JM has a way of saying it that I really like as well, this idea of inheriting the earth. And he says, a new ripeness shall bring renewed inspiration and confident strength will flow through them. And there is a restoration that I found in these practices that does bring, you know, that idea of earth is, you know, the represented as the physical, right? Who we are in the physical, like the heaven and the earth, the consciousness and the physical kind of coming together. And it's almost, I'd say what happened for me is I used to be, you know, prior to doing these tools over the years, I used to be kind of like a duck. And someone described me that way when I was in business. So like, you're like a duck. You look really calm on the surface, but you're paddling like crazy, you know, with all your insecurities underneath. And it's true. I was so insecure. I didn't have a strong bone in my body in terms of what I really thought. So I was very malleable, and I would try to get, you know, people to like me. And that was a big deal for me. Spent a lot of time. I went into sales, and it's a common thing for people in sales, too. It's like I made that a priority. And when people liked me, I got, you know, so that process of unwinding that and getting to a place where no longer was I kind of this foreigner in my body feeling anxious and uncomfortable, but suddenly I, quote unquote, inherited the earth. There was this new ripeness. There was this settling in, right? There was this groundedness. And from that, confidence started to flow over time, and I became more aware of what my secondary purpose was. And that's key, because I remember the first time I did the secondary purpose exercise with you in 2012 down in Florida.
Right.
There was a I still remember eating that juicy grapefruit off the tree. There was a desire to get it right. Like, oh, I got to do the secondary purpose, you know, because the primary purpose everybody's got. So the secondary purpose, so what's mine? And I wanted to get it really perfect. But I was coming from the carbon-based mind. It was coming from this place of, like, well, what's right? You know, what do I, quote-unquote, need and all that stuff? And over time, just doing these, my secondary purpose really shifted quite a bit. You know, I moved out of technology. I moved into, you know, caring more about supporting people and finding these tools and developing themselves into, you know, the best life force that could come in their world, considering their family and friends and whatever it is that they touch, and became more of a priority for me. Like, well, that there's nothing more interesting to me than seeing a human being fully live. So
sure,
trust, if you've done the purpose exercise, trust, it might change as you do these beatitudes. It might not change necessarily dramatically, but it could alter, even if it's just the intention from which it comes.
Yeah, my experience over the years is I suggest that people carry the net result. And if anybody hasn't done the purpose workshop, the worksheet's pretty self-explanatory. If you just go to whyagain.org or through the app, you go to the page with links to the website, and you'll find the worksheet. Again, it's pretty self-explanatory. And the net result of that, I suggest that people carry that on a 3x5 card in their purse, their wallet, whatever. And every time they're going to do something important, they check it out. Is it in alignment with this primary and secondary purposes that I've established? And as we clean out carbon-based memory if it's garbage, it's going to shift, like mega shift, in terms of what we perceive as our purpose. That's going to be, we're going to move out of the world game and into the game of what human life was really designed for. And for most people, that's a pretty major shift that happens.
And one of the things that we've experienced with Journey's Dream is we kind of have our vision of what the world looks like when there's no more mental illness. So in the beginning, we did these vision exercises, and we thought, oh, wow, we want, you know, this practitioner database where people come and find, you know, practitioners who believe in your full restoration to health. Like, that would be really cool. And we want this, you know, app to do this, you know, study of a scale of where someone is for that day and track it over time so people can have self-realization and stuff. And we had all these visions of, you know, dozens of things. And we felt discouraged in the beginning that we weren't able to do it fast enough or complete enough. And one of the things that happened one day is there was this experience of something that we had envisioned coming to us from another organization. And we knew we'd wanted to collaborate with others. But when we saw that, it's like, wait a minute, we didn't even have to build it. Essentially, that divine force is moving through people who are willing, right, and ripe, you know, for their inner world to be purified and then carry something out into the outer world that's going to be really constructive. And we've seen that kind of thing happen at least 6-7 times already, and it'll probably grow magnificently over the years because now we're more aware of, wait, just because we have it in our vision doesn't mean ours to do. It could be that just a revelation of something that's being created. So this goes back to the Lord's Prayer where it's like, give us this day our daily bread. You know, to give me today what it is that I need most. And to surrender into that and trust, you know, the mind goal management system that we will receive in that, the, you know, pure space, the insights that we most need for today, and we don't need to worry about tomorrow. You know, we can create plans and things, but tomorrow will take care of tomorrow. Today, focus on what it is that's optimal right now. So that coming together is really interesting to me. It's magnificent to see.
Yeah, you trigger in me, you know, you recognize that there are several inventions. If you check patent offices, that appeared in several places around the globe, things being patented literally on the same day in different countries, just, you know, like light years apart from each other, no communication, but the same patent was given in three different countries the same day, when you realize there's definitely a different energy going on there. And the year you were at Heartland, do you remember, did we play the movie Brother Sun, Sister Moon?
I don't remember the movie, no.
Okay. Well, there's
you might have played it, but I don't remember it.
Well, as you're speaking, you might want to look this up and just spend some time listening to this piece of music. It's from the movie Brother Sun, Sister Moon, which is the story of St. Francis of Assisi. But if you look on YouTube, it's and Jeannie, I'll send you the link. You might want to just put it in the notes. But if you look on YouTube and search for If You Want Your Dream to Be, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, and it's just a powerful piece. And basically what it says is, take your time, go slowly. Small beginnings, greater ends. That's powerful.
I wrote it down. I'll look that up after the show.
Yeah, cool. And I'm sending the link to Jeannie, so she'll have it. So let's take a look at our next beatitude. Let's see, we're down to about 6 minutes. We can probably cover one more. And this one, the Greeks say, says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and they shall be filled. And it's interesting to hear people, especially in the theological realm, talking about their righteous anger as though there was such a thing. I love what Einstein says about anger. It's found only in the bosom of fools. And yet many people think it's their, you know, it's like their mainstay. It's what motivates them. It's what works for them. And they don't realize the compromise of intelligence. It's there with that righteous anger. But in Aramaic, that beatitude says, you who hunger for, and the word in Aramaic is kenuta, and it's a mind structure, literally a tuv. Remember the tuv, whom the beatitudes, the creator plants in your mind neural structures. This is just a tattoo. So what it's saying is the mind structure underlying the attitude, judgment, and behavior described by just and fair behavior between people. And you look at carbon-based memory, and so much is based on greed and fear and getting and possession and all of that. And this one says that ultimately, what each of us needs to work with this carbon-based memory system is to cultivate literally a mind structure that the first order of business is always just and fair rather than the non-being mind's games of greed and fear and pain and trauma. And what the result is, in the Greeks say, if you've got that righteousness, you shall be filled. In Aramaic, what it says if that neural structure, if you're hungering for that neural structure, and you get that activated, then it will become your, again, it will become your possession. You'll attain it. How's that one impacted you, Mark?
So it's right on. And for me, one of the things that I experienced with this is when I saw the fruits of using the practice 1, 2, and 3, and saw it again and again and again, that hunger began to develop, right? That change in me shifted from, okay, this is something nice to do when I'm in pain, to, no, this is something that is a way of life. You know, in the Hebrew, I wouldn't be able to pronounce the name correctly, but I think it's sadia, is one who follows the correct path, you know, the path of God, or et cetera, which might sound a little close to righteousness rather than the Aramaic. But one of the things that I found is that there is this desire that births forth for what it is that's occurring. And for me, I had this insight that came periodically that would kind of almost give me a glimpse of the next state, right? This next state of, and I failed a lot. You know, I would get an insight to do something in the world that would have been really effective for me. And I got the insight, but I had fear and wouldn't necessarily always follow it. And then I would see that, oh, that would have been a good insight to follow. And so that created even more hunger.
We've got 1 minute.
Go back and do more of the Beatitudes. Yes, I'll wrap up. Maybe well, more of the Beatitudes, yeah, and keep going to refine, refine, refine. But there's an inner and an outer. there's two things. One is to see it in others, as you mentioned, and the other is to really hunger for it in us. Because for me, when I went to me first and clarified that, then it made it easier for me to see it in others.
Right. And these mind structures, as you're developing them, it's good to recognize that they can be quite fragile. You know, if you remember the first time you went into French class or German class or Spanish class, whatever it was in school, and they spoke in that language, you went, what do you even do? I mean, that means nothing. And then, well, you know, after three weeks in class, it was a certain, oh, yeah, I can say oui, merci, but it's fragile, collapses easily, and ongoing connected work is what makes those mind structures strong.